You think all the coverage and ads around the Supreme Court and the nomination has been a lot? Oh, you ain't seen nothing yet. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, July the 10th. Great as always to have you along, everybody. There was a whole lot of theater and some modicum of surprise in President Trump's nomination last night of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. What's coming next is going to be absolutely no surprise at all, mostly because it's already started. The 24/7, 360-degree, when-will-it-end onslaught of political advertising from those for and against Kavanaugh's nomination. Over the next couple of months, give or take, tens of millions of dollars, more in reality, is going to be spent to influence the people who will decide whether or not Kavanaugh gets that job. Marketplace's Rima Kreis gets us going.
The orchestra, the earnestness, the call to action. They're here.
Call your senators and tell them to oppose Trump's extreme nominee. Stop Brett Kavanaugh.
That ad from Demand Justice, a progressive group, was out last night. So was this one from Judicial Crisis Network, a conservative advocacy group.
Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh is the best of the best. Strong and independent, he applies the Constitution just as it was written.
Both groups plan to spend millions on TV, radio, and digital ads in the run-up to confirmation hearings. So does Americans for Prosperity, a conservative group funded by the Koch brothers. Sarah Field is vice president of judicial strategy. She says,
everything we do is done with the focus of where we can make an impact. Our sense is that we can make the biggest impact in North Dakota, West Virginia, Indiana.
Red states, with Democratic senators who voted for Trump's first Supreme Court pick, Justice Neil Gorsuch, and are up for re-election. But the states that are likely to be most bombarded with ads? Alaska and Maine, home to Republican Senators Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, both supporters of abortion rights and the politicians most likely to tip the balance.
This is the Super Bowl for us, so we're putting every resource we have into it.
Lori Kenny is the communications director for Alliance for Justice, a progressive group. She says her organization has been digging through Kavanaugh's records.
We do have lawyers and researchers here who are literally reading thousands of pages of cases around the clock.
Combing through Kavanaugh's media appearances, law review articles, even his social media, anything that'll give her group more fodder for more ads. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Not only does actual nature abhor a vacuum, turns out economic nature does, too. I mention that by way of noting that Chinese Premier Li Keqiang has been in Europe the past couple of days. He met with Eastern European leaders over the weekend. He's set to meet with German Chancellor Angela Merkel before heading back to Beijing soon to prepare for another set of meetings with other European leaders. As President Trump starts meetings with NATO allies this week, many of whom are on the receiving end of White House tariffs, it's worth noting that China is working real hard to get cozy with Europe. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more now on how the rest of the world is responding to present American trade policy.
The U.S. has alienated Europe. The U.S. has alienated China. Now China and Europe are talking.
This is a strategic response by China.
Lee Brandstetter is a professor of economics at Carnegie Mellon University. As the U.S. has stepped out of the global trading system, withdrawing from agreements and attacking allies, China appears quite happy to step in.
China sees this as an opportunity to bind these two very large economies under a set of rules that favor Chinese interests.
Now, the problem that China faces in trying to get cozy with Europe and other countries is that the rest of the world is just as frustrated with Chinese economic policy as the U.S. is. Robert Manning is with the Atlantic Council.
Up until a few years ago, the European attitude was, let's make deals with China. And I think over the last couple of few years, they've grown wary of Chinese industrial policies.
But what China is getting out of the hostility between the U.S. and Europe and Japan and Korea and Mexico and Canada is that there is no longer a strong united front against China.
We have had a tremendous lost opportunity.
Eric Altbach is with the Albright Stonebridge Group. When the U.S. withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and a major trade agreement with Europe, it lost carrots it could offer China.
We're really losing the opportunity to build a coordinated approach with our trading partners and allies to pressure China to change some of its problematic behaviors.
Meanwhile, other U.S. trading partners, aside from China, are busy pursuing deals with one another. The EU is wrapping up trade agreements with Canada, Japan, and Mexico. Simon Lester is with the Cato Institute.
As the EU and others forge ahead, that does put U.S. producers who are trying to sell in these same export markets, it does put them at a disadvantage.
If you're not at the table, you're on the menu. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The word of the day on Wall Street today was Pepsi. A nifty quarterly earnings report from that company lifted the whole consumer staples sector. Also, to channel traders here, if I might, of late and again, trade war? What trade war? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Ask a real estate analyst about the residential real estate market in this country, and one of the top couple of things she is going to mention is affordable housing, or the lack of it, actually. What's happening is more cities deal with gentrification and short housing supply, and longtime residents get pushed out because they just can't afford it anymore. The reaction to that, in rental markets specifically, is that tenants' rights groups are pushing back, and they're pushing back by pushing rent control. California's going to have a ballot measure this fall that would repeal a state law that prevents cities from putting rent caps on most housing, or in straight English, it would let cities widen their rent control ordinances. Marketplace's Aaron Schrenk explains what that's going to mean.
For years, 63-year-old Aminta paid around $1,000 for a two-bedroom apartment in Huntington Park, south of Los Angeles. Then came the rent increases.
My landlord raised my rent last year by $125. And when the building was bought out by new landlords this year, they increased it by $250 more.
There's no rent control laws in her city. Landlords can jack up rents however much they want. I'm not using Aminta's full name because she's scared her landlord might retaliate. I met her seeking advice at the L.A. office of the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, or ACE. It's one of the groups planning to spend tens of millions overturning the state's rent control law. Amy Schur is the nonprofit's state campaign director.
The only policy solution that's going to tackle displacement is some form of controlling skyrocketing rents.
Cities use rent control laws to keep monthly payments down for tenants and protect them from eviction. Most California cities don't have them, and the state law in question prevents those that do, like LA, from regulating rents on newer apartment buildings. Less than 20% of the state's rental units currently fall under some rent control, according to state analysts. More than 60% would be eligible if the law changes. Still, Schur points out a repeal won't actually create any new rent laws.
We are just getting rid of a bad law that put restrictions on what cities can do to deal with rent gouging. It's going to be up to local cities to decide what regulations they want.
About a dozen California cities have plans to expand rent control. The California Apartment Association has lined up $60 million to convince voters to stop those plans. Deborah Carlton handles PR for the association.
We just fear that this is going to add fuel to an already difficult situation in California.
Carlton says if the repeal passes, property owners will be tempted to convert their rental units to condos. Investors and developers may also build fewer apartments, making California's affordable housing crisis even worse. Matthew Millen owns three apartment buildings in Santa Monica, a city that has some rent control regs and is proposing to expand them if the state law is overturned.
If that all passes, I'd probably consider selling out.
Millen lives in one of his units, next to a tenant who's been there 25 years, and thanks to rent control, pays well below the $2,700 market rent.
He and his wife now make about $25,000 a month, drive a 2017 Mercedes-Benz, and pay me $950 a month in rent. If all the units were like that, I'll just go out of business. I'll sell the building to some developers.
Rent control policies usually save some lucky renters money, but can drive up rents for everybody else. So says economist Jim Costello at Real Capital Analytics.
The fundamental problem is that there just are not enough housing units to go around. You limit the supply, and the price goes up.
Stanford researchers found that San Francisco's rent control law led to landlords taking 15% of rent-controlled units off the market. That triggered a 5% increase in rents citywide, beyond inflation. CEO Bob Hart at apartment landlord True America Multifamily worries the same thing will happen across the state if the law changes.
you open the door for municipalities to adopt not just rent control, but very draconian rent control.
Polls show 60% of California voters favor limits on how much landlords can charge. But adopting rent control is easier said than done. In the past 30 years, just two California cities managed to approve new ordinances. Voters and city leaders rejected rent control measures and many more. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
It's kind of gotten a little bit lost in the news fire hose that 2018 is turning out to be, but this year is year 10 since the financial crisis. It's 10 years since the recession and 10 years since this economy changed in ways we are still trying to figure out. Our project about the past decade in our collective economic lives is called Divided Decade, and one of the things we're doing is a first-person series about the big and small ways people's lives were affected by it called How We Changed. Today, Daphne Quay out of Austin, Texas.
My mother has been selling real estate since I was 8, and she has a single mom, and I'm an only child. So I would really see the work that she would put in to her business. In 2008, I was just turning 20, and I was living at home with my mom in Minneapolis. My original plan was to take a year off school so I could work and save some money and pay for my own college. Because in Minneapolis, we started seeing really strong signs of an economic downturn in late 2006, and what was once very, very alive and vibrant just kind of shriveled up and died. I mean, it was really living on the wire. And I know my mom was frustrated and a little scared. And it was tough to see her because she got so depressed. I knew that was probably our new way of life for a while. Nobody knew how long it was going to last. So I started working full-time as a personal trainer at a local gym. I remember one week, like, I logged my hours and it was like 65 or 70 hours just to try to be able to support myself as much as I could and not be a burden for my mom. She didn't really see an upturn in her business again until about 2012. That's almost 6 years of living in absolute uncertainty, bad economy. It was hard. It was really hard. I was kind of stuck and bored, and I knew I wasn't really doing what I could do. So I talked to my mom, and she helped me get my real estate license, and then things took off from there. My outlook has changed completely. There was a period where I almost didn't want to know what was happening with the economy, but now I want to know. I've studied market trends. I study world economies. I've studied what caused the crash in 2008. So I think being informed is a really good way to be able to create almost like an umbrella or a protection. But I always live with a little minor terror that the economy could crash the way it did, and I don't want to relive that.
We've got a picture of Daphne Quay on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM there. Take a minute, actually, while you're looking at that, and let us know how the financial crisis changed you, would you? The hashtag we're using is How We Changed. Coming up.
Oh, I'm going to get skunked today. And like I sat down and there was one right beside me.
Oh, man. The things people do for a dollar and a good meal. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 143 points today, about a half percent, 24,919. The NASDAQ up 2 points. We'll call that flat, really, 77.59. S&P 500 gained 9 points, 0.3%, 27.93. Pepsi, as I mentioned, bubbled up 4.7% today on those higher-than-expected profits. Falling sales of soft drinks were offset by sales of snacks. Go figure that. Coca-Cola sweetened 1.2%. National Beverage, maker of Crystal Bay fruit drinks, flattened 1.3% today. Nordstrom went south 2.6% after issuing sales guidance for the year that disappointed analysts. Macy's swung up 0.7%. Energy stocks were higher as oil supply disruptions in Norway and Libya pushed up oil prices. Chevron gushed up 1.2% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note up to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace. We heard from Catherine in Bellingham, Washington the other day, who says she finds great value in how Marketplace explains things like tax reform and how changing fiscal policy affects our lives. If you agree with Catherine, please join her by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to Catherine and all the Marketplace investors who make our work possible. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. President Trump's had a lot on his plate this week. The Supreme Court nomination, as we were talking about earlier, his big European trip as well, landed in Brussels earlier this afternoon, by the way, for those NATO meetings that start tomorrow. Then Queen Elizabeth and Vladimir Putin later on. But in between all that, he found time yesterday to go after another American company on his Twitter feed. Here's what he said on Monday. Quote, Pfizer and others should be ashamed that they have raised drug prices for no reason, end of quote. Pfizer did, in fact, raise prices earlier this month on about 10% of its medications, the company says. Among them, Viagra. But the thing is that even as the branded market for erectile dysfunction drugs is getting more expensive, the generic side of that business is booming. Last month, the Food and Drug Administration cleared five companies to produce and sell the generic Sildenafil. And lo and behold, capitalism being what it is, prices for that Viagra substitute have already begun to fall. From the health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at how Pfizer continues to profit from its ED drug while companies are elbowing their way into that multi-billion dollar market.
Until Viagra hit the scene in the late 90s, treatment options for erectile dysfunction were limited. One drug on the market, Cavraject, had to be injected in a sensitive spot. Kent Bernard was a lawyer with Pfizer for 28 years.
When we acquired Pharmacia, which owned Upjohn, which owned that product, we actually had access to the training tapes. I have to tell you, having watched those once, you would not want to come within a mile of using that product.
So it's probably no surprise Viagra brought in boatloads of revenue for Pfizer, more than $25 billion, according to market research company Statista. One reason? Commercials like these.
Viagra, America's most prescribed.
Viagra, or at least its legacy, lives on. Pfizer's extensive marketing campaign helped demystify erectile dysfunction. 62 million men around the world have taken the drug since it launched in 1998. As the Viagra patent sunsets, Pfizer is doing whatever it can to hold on to the market. Scott Hemphill of NYU says Pfizer figures, if you can't beat them, join them.
The branded firm sees generics coming and says, I can do that. And they get into the generic business themselves. If you can make a couple billion dollars, why wouldn't you?
To goose profits, Pfizer launched its own generic late last year at a discount of about 50%. That's a time-worn strategy for drug makers. On top of that, the company just boosted the list price of its branded Viagra to $74 a pill, a 9% jump. Pfizer declined to comment for this story, but the company is betting that some consumers will always prefer the branded product. Tori Marsh with the consumer website GoodRx says Pfizer's Viagra still has 15% of the market.
It's kind of a testament to how well Pfizer has done with having this huge marketing around Viagra and the branding, and it's been a really big success.
Today, the American Urological Association estimates as many as 30 million men are affected by ED. That is a huge market. The five manufacturers getting in it will sell their version of the generic Sildenafil at prices ranging from $30 a pill to as little as 60 cents per pill, according to analytics company Elsevier. Tori Marsh with GoodRx expects the feeding frenzy to intensify.
The fact that the fills for Viagra are dropping and fills for generics are increasing, more and more companies are going to see that this is a good play.
GoodRx finds that plummeting prices have lured in more customers. University of Pittsburgh urologist Ben Davies says he's beginning to prescribe generics to his patients.
We can easily get generic versions of Sildenafil, mostly through wholesale pharmacies like Costco, has a $4 version for 20 milligrams. Patients commonly will go there, get their steak and their Viagra together, and make it a day.
One of Viagra's competitors, Cialis, is expected to lose its patent protections this fall, which means more low-cost alternatives flooding the market. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We're going to do a little food economics now, a sector that is A, a place where consumers are really price sensitive, but also B, a place where those prices can sometimes vary pretty widely. Today's case in point, wild mushrooms. Like anything else, prices for wild mushrooms are driven not just by taste, but also by supply and demand. So Brita Green reports now from New Hampshire on one attempt to get an edge in the wild mushroom market.
For Tad Montgomery, this whole endeavor starts with a story from his childhood in the Midwest. As he tells it, he was working out in the garden with his mom and siblings when a thunderstorm rolled in, and they all ran under nearby trees for shelter.
And my sister, Winifred, said, "Mom, what are these things? They're really weird."
Being an amateur naturalist, his mom piled the kids in the car, samples in hand, and drove them, soaking wet, to visit the town librarian.
And she looked at us and she stood up and she said, "Morels! You found morels!"
And so began Montgomery's lifelong pursuit of one of the most desired fungi. Picture a cone-shaped mushroom with a brain-like cap sitting low on the forest floor. "It's not just that morels are delicious," says Steve Witchland, who runs a mushroom business in southern New Hampshire. He cultivates mushrooms, but also forages wild varieties. And he says morels are also particularly tough to find.
"Because they kind of look like a wrinkled leaf. I've actually had times that I was looking for like hours for them. And like I was like, oh, I'm going to get skunked today. And like I sat down and there was one right beside me."
Here in the Northeast, the best farm-to-table restaurants will pay upwards of $20 per pound for morels. In places like New York City, Witchland says, it's even higher, more like $30 per pound. That's more than oyster mushrooms, shiitakes, even hen of the woods, and sometimes chanterelles. And that's why people all over the world have been trying to figure out how to cultivate morels, essentially farm them like any other crop. It's something of a holy grail in mushrooming circles.
It's probably really been focused on the last 20 or 30 years. And it's really kind of getting some pressure now because people, you know, they see value in it.
He says morels are difficult to grow for a host of reasons. For one, they're really finicky, not just about temperature and moisture conditions, but also about the medium, the soil or plant material that they're grown on. Today, Montgomery's working in an orchard right on the Vermont-New Hampshire border.
I am now taking a pitchfork and fairly lightly just plunging it into the soil.
After making holes in the ground at the base of a tree, he reaches for a bucket with a liquid mixture containing morel spores. Those are the reproductive unit of the mushrooms. He scoops out cupfuls of the liquid and pours it over the holes he's made on the ground. Steve Wood looks on as Montgomery works. He's been operating the business here, an orchard and cidery, for decades.
Everybody who knows anything about mushrooms knows that morels grow in apple orchards.
As he points out, morels are known to favor certain trees, including apple trees. That's why Wood's letting Montgomery experiment on his land. Montgomery's idea is morels could become something of a second crop here. He's hoping the orchard could provide a critical fertile ground for cultivation. As an investment, this experiment isn't costing him much, mostly just his time. And as for Wood, the orchard owner, he sees more upside than downside as well.
"What the hell? I mean, exactly how does this hurt me? You know, I mean, this is great. He's going to try to get something growing we like."
One, two, three, four.
Montgomery flips through a little brown notebook, ticking off sites where he spread his spore concoction.
12, 13, 14.
He's been trying this for several years now, each year tweaking his recipe and taking careful notes on climate conditions.
"I haven't had any success yet. None."
This time, he's using spores from mushrooms that were actually found at other orchards rather than out in the woods. He's hoping that could do the trick. "So now we wait until next year," Montgomery says, smiling. "You never really know when they'll pop up." In Lebanon, New Hampshire, I'm Brita Green for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk: of you push one way on the global economy, the balloon has to give someplace else. Dateline Frankfurt, Germany, by way of Spartanburg, South Carolina. BMW says that in response to the present Sino-American trade unpleasantness, that it's going to start making more of its SUVs in China to get around last week's Washington-Beijing tariff-a-thon, and it's going to raise prices on the South Carolina-built cars that it sells into the Chinese market. Here's the quote. BMW says it is not in a position to completely absorb the tariff increases, which is the way tariffs are supposed to work, both on what we send overseas and the stuff that we buy here from overseas. All right, that's all we got. The Dow Industrials up 143 today, about a half percent. NASDAQ basically flat. S&P 500 up 9.3%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.